hearing, Counsel.
May it please the Court. I am Tom Rice, and I represent the defendant's appellants, the Hilton Hotel Retirement Plan, et al. The principal claim in this case, and the one I'd like to discuss this morning, is the plaintiff's claim that the plan, the benefit plan in this case, was backloaded. That is, that the rate at which benefits accrued in early years of a participant's career accrued more slowly than ERISA requires. As it turns out, after this case was commenced, the IRS determined, and in fact it turns out, that the plan was backloaded, that it did not satisfy any...
Right. Now, that's a given, right? That it didn't satisfy us.
Absolutely. That is a given, Your Honor.
So what issue is it you're rising to at the moment?
Our issue is that after this case was commenced, the plan was amended. The plan was amended specifically in order to comply with one of the three alternative tests, the so-called fractional rule, and that as a result, the claim was moot. That was presented to the
I want to make sure I've got this straight. Everybody agrees that the plan did not comply with any of the three backloading devices, right? Or anti-backloading devices, right?
Yes, the IRS has determined that, and we don't contest it.
There's no question it came into court. There was a controversy that the court had the jurisdiction to resolve, right?
At the beginning of the case?
No question about that.
Absolutely. The beginning of the case, that's correct.
No question about that. Now, you're claiming that you can, by passing an amendment, which is itself controversial as to whether it in fact solves the problems of the initial defect, deprive the court of jurisdiction to remedy the defect that you admit was there. Is that your position?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You do have some other arguments this morning.
Absolutely, we have other arguments to make as well, Your Honor. But I think that, but first, as a matter of the constitutional power of the courts, I mean, it's clear that the court has to have jurisdiction,
I'm really at a loss to figure that you really think you're going to prevail on saying you can deprive the court of jurisdiction by stepping in with an amendment to the plan when you've admitted that the plan was flawed in the past, and you're trying to deprive the court of jurisdiction to determine the effect of that flaw and the remedy for that effect unilaterally amending the plan in a fashion that remains controversial.
Your Honor, I don't think it is controversial as between the parties. I don't think
you read the briefs, didn't you?
Absolutely, I read.
You know the other side controversy, right?
Absolutely,
right. Okay.
And I think, Your Honor, here the principal error that the court made below is in finding that the amendment to the plan here did not cure the backloading problem, and that is both a matter of mootness, and it also goes to whether or not there was a legal error that made any exercise of discretion as to the remedy an abuse of discretion. And I think it's important, Your Honor, to outline how where the court went here, which was finding that the only basis on which this plan could comply with the anti-backloading rules was satisfying one of three tests that ERISA
says. I don't know that that's actually what she said. The court below entered a remedy in an equitable case that undid or corrected the flaw in the plan. But she did not necessarily say that was the only way it could have been done. She did it the way that the plan itself suggested, but...
Your Honor, honestly, I beg to differ. What the court said was, in this case, it said that the plan here selected 133 and a third percent rule as the basis on which it would comply.
That was true, right?
No, it's not true, Your Honor. It did not select
You read the plan?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And it says... 133 and a third percent is the method, right?
What it says, Your Honor, what it says in Section 5.4, what it said starting in 1994, it didn't say anything about that from 1976 to 1994, right. But what it said starting in 1994 was that it is the intention of the plan that the benefit formula that's set forth in Article 4 complies with the version of the 133 and a third rule that's contained in the Internal Revenue Code.
You were not correct a moment ago when you said the plan didn't say that.
No, what I said, Your Honor, is the plan did not select. What the plan did was make a statement of fact as to what it thought it was accomplishing by the benefit formula that it did there. It turns out it was
wrong. You concede that it did that. Make a statement as to what it was aiming for, 133%.
Of course I concede it.
Couldn't have done that without selecting it, could they? It didn't say we comply with the 3% solution. It didn't say we comply with the fractional solution. It said we comply or we intend to comply with under 33%.
What it said, Your Honor, is the provision of the plan that what was in the plan was intended to comply with that rule, absolutely.
Right.
What it didn't say...
The court had not erred yet in what you read from the court when she said it selected that.
No, well, Your Honor, that is not a selection. A selection is when... The selection is, for example, in the Supreme Court's decision in Curtis Wright, right, where ERISA says you have to select a particular... process or procedure for amending a plan. If a plan selects one, it's bound by it. That's what that says. Here, ERISA doesn't say you have to select. ERISA says you can use any of them. And all that happened here is there was a statement in the plan that said, really directed to the IRS because it's talking
accepting
about...
Accepting the whole argument on that, and we've read it as well as hearing what you said today, I'm still not sure how you think the court loses jurisdiction from mootness when the way you corrected it was by a unilateral amendment, which would certainly leave the chance of recurrence.
Oh, Your Honor, I think there the record is so clear that there is under this court's and under the Supreme Court's jurisdiction on voluntary cessation mootness. Mm-hmm. I think it's so clear here that this was moot and that there is not on the record that there's not a substantial or reasonable likelihood of repetition. And let me explain why. This isn't a case where an agency just, you know, after an action is commenced, grant somebody something, and they'll be absolutely free to go ahead and change it. Here the plan has made a change.
Here you assert that when you get under fire for your plan, you can unilaterally assert it and pull it out of court. I mean, you've already used that tactic, so I don't see how you can possibly say it's not likely to recur.
No, in this case, it's likely to recur. The reason it's not likely to occur, Your Honor, is twofold. One is that because having made an amendment and having increased the benefits in order to comply with the fractional rule, under ERISA, that cannot be undone. It's the very same anti-cutback rule that you hear about from the plaintiff. It would, in this case, would prevent the plan from now decreasing the benefits in order to make them backloaded. Secondly, one of the important things here is when faced with this problem, my client went to the IRS and said, you know, take a look at this. If it is backloaded, you know, please don't disqualify us from 1976 to the present and on to the future. And the IRS, it's right in the record, said we're not gonna continue the qualification of the plan going forward, and we're not gonna disqualify you on a going back basis because you acted in good faith, because you relied on periodic tax qualification decisions by the IRS that said this is okay, and because you weren't acting in any way other than in good faith is what it uses. If following this decision or following this case and following the amendment, they were to go back on it, they would be subject to tax disqualification, which cases have called the kind of the nuclear bomb of court of enforcement. So this is not a case like the Donovan case where somebody can just, you know, pick up and go back to their old ways. This is a case where the plan has taken binding action to amend the plan to eliminate the problem here and to eliminate the violation. That under the jurisprudence relating to voluntary cessation, that doesn't.
Doesn't the opposing side argue that some people lose under the amendment? Some plan members lose under the amendment.
I think what they argue is that some people, that it's a definition of loss, that some people in later years accrue benefits at a lower rate. They don't
Whether
lose
they're
anything.
Right or wrong, that doesn't sound like mootness, does it?
It absolutely is mootness, Your Honor, and it absolutely is legal error that infected the remedies decision as well on both of those fronts. Nobody lost anything. The plan amendment that was done here was a greater...
Lost anything compared to what?
Lost
anything compared to what they were legally entitled to. Right?
Absolutely.
And what they were legally entitled to, as I understand your theory, is one of the three ways of complying.
Actually, Your Honor, what they're legally entitled to protection against
explain a little more. They're not entitled, under your theory, to the 133 1/3, even though there was the statement of intent. They are entitled to one of the three ways of complying.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And
right, so to the extent they lost compared to what they would have been entitled to under the 133 and a third, that doesn't matter legally, is your theory, because they didn't lose compared to what they are entitled to under one of the three options that you could legally use.
Legally, equitably, any other way, Your Honor, right. That's absolutely right. I mean, what ERISA protects is from cutback is the accrued benefit. That is what the person is entitled to get when as of their normal retirement age.
Are they able to get now everything that they would have been able to get if the fractional rule had been in place?
Absolutely.
The whole time?
Absolutely.
Okay, right. And the fractional rule is obviously lawful.
The fractional rule is lawful, and further...
So when you say they haven't lost, you're saying compared to what they were legally entitled to and...
Well, right, yes, and they also haven't lost.
The other side will say, but they were legally entitled to the 133 and a third because of the statement of intent, and that
absolutely,
ultimately which we have to figure out.
Which I do want to spend a little bit more time on why that is incorrect, but let me just two things that they're not cut back on at all. They're not cut back on what they would have gotten under a fractional rule plan. They also don't lose a penny in terms of benefits from what they got under the original plan. This is a greater of plan that says if under the fractional rule leg of it,
we understand that. What they lost compared to is what they would have gotten if 133 and a third were required.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the ultimate issue we have to figure out is whether you were required to stick with 133 and a third based on the statement of intent.
That's exactly right. And let me just reasons why I think that that the court should find that the plan was not legally required to comply with the 133 and a third percent rule. I mean, the first is ERISA. ERISA says any of the three. And the cases and the regulations say that you give substantial flexibility to the plans in meeting the benefit accrual rules. There's the Lonicki case out of the Second Circuit that says when the plan realized there might be a problem with respect to complying with the 133 and a third percent rule, depending on what happened in interest rates in that, they amended the plan to say, well, if that is a problem for any individual, we're gonna give an additional benefit to that person that complies with the fractional rule.
Taking it to the nature of this case, then, I realize I'm quibbling with semantics, but the whole case is quibbling with semantics. Instead of phrasing it that the court held that you were required to use 133 and a third percent formula, if you had not filed the amendment, would you agree that it would have been within the authority of the court to enter the 133% solution that she did here?
Would it have been with? It would have been an exercise. It would have been a question of what her appropriate discretion was in that regard.
Right.
And I would say, Your Honor, in that regard,
could she have done it and lawfully entered that remedy absent your amendment?
I would argue, Your Honor, no, because
what relief could she have ordered?
Okay, she could have ordered relief that would require the plan to comply with one of the benefit accrual rules in ERISA. ERISA, the entire underpinning of ERISA is you give flexibility to the plan in coming up with a scheme that complies with kind of the minimum criteria here. It would have been appropriate for her to say comply, but she should
comply
have
with
it,
one of the three comply with one, legal
it,
options.
Exactly, and leave it to the plan sponsor to decide which of the legal options it was going to comply with. I would say anything other than that would have been an abuse of discretion for the court to have done that. I think ultimately what the court did here is...
Go ahead a little more with your phrasing of the agreement, or the phrase. I know you didn't draft it, but you've agreed that the 133% language is in there. In fact, you read it to us verbatim. Why is that in there unless it is the plan is supposed to be going under 133 and a third percent?
I think the reason it's there, Your Honor, is number one, it's addressed not to the people who are suing here. It's addressed to the IRS. How do we know that? Because it doesn't say we're going to comply with 133 and a third percent rule that's in ERISA, which gives them rights.
If it's addressed to Santa Claus and the elves, why is it in there?
All right, but the reason it's addressed to the Internal Revenue Code, and it tells the Internal Revenue Code, when you look at this plan, here's what we think we're doing. So when you're going to test it for purposes of deciding whether or not our tax qualified status should be granted or continued, here's what you should look at. Essentially, don't, it's an aid to them. The same way that a similar statement that's in these Form 5300s, which are also given to the IRS, is there. That's what it's there for. It's a statement of intent. It's for anybody who's looking at this.
It says, IRS, we've selected this method.
Also, again, Your Honor, you're using the word selected.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. They're not selecting.
Nobody selected that one for them. Somebody chose that language.
And the language itself is not a selection. It's a statement of an intention. It's not something which says,
if you'd put in all three, they wouldn't have been selecting. Once they put in one, they're making a selection, counsel. As I said, the whole case is...
All they're doing, Your Honor, is saying when we designed this plan, we thought we were complying with this rule as opposed to others. What it doesn't do is say we can't amend the plan. ERISA and the plan say they can amend the plan. It doesn't say that we can't amend the intention. The intention was amended with the IRS's blessing. It doesn't say anything about what's going to happen if that statement of fact turns out to be false. What does say something is ERISA, and ERISA says you can use any three, and it was just error for the district judge to hold otherwise. Ultimately, if you read her decision, she's really kind of stopping the plan. She's saying you selected it. Again, we don't think she selected it. You represented it. You did something, and therefore you should have to live with that. That's what she's saying.
Sorry. Whether that was correct depends, as Chief Judge Sintel says, on whether the original language was a selection for purposes of ERISA.
I think that's absolutely right, but even if it was right, relief in the nature of an estoppel in ERISA or elsewhere requires evidence of reasonable reliance. Here there's no.
Well, I understand that argument, but your stronger, or at least your preliminary argument to that, is that it wasn't an ERISA
absolutely, Your Honor.
Binding statement.
Absolutely. It's clear. I think on the face, it's a statement of fact. It's not something that anybody can fairly read to be binding. Now,
it's there just for the IRS. No one's supposed to read that and assume. The workers are not supposed to assume that's what they're entitled to after reading that. I think the rational worker would read that and assume that's what we're getting, 130.
I think the rational worker would, number one, look at the benefit as described as to what they're getting to the extent somebody's looking at it. That's what they think they're entitled to, whether it complies with one rule or another. They're not thinking about that. But if they're looking at the plan...
Why do you say that? I mean, people are pretty astute about their retirement benefits and would look at that and assume that's what we're going to get.
Because what you're going to get is clearly defined in Article 4. It says you're going to get 2% of your average monthly compensation times your years of benefit.
But you might not challenge the plan if you were believing that it complied with the 1.33 and the 3% solution, or you might otherwise challenge it. Would that not be possible?
The plaintiff has alleged essentially that it was in there to kind of mislead. I mean, it was in there because that's what people thought they were doing. I don't think that doesn't really go to the question of when it turns out it wasn't correct, the understanding how you go about fixing it. As I said, ERISA tells you how to fix it.
ERISA does not explicitly tell you how to fix it.
Pardon me.
ERISA does not tell you how to fix it.
It absolutely does not tell you how to fix it. It does not. The plan provides.
Tell you how to fix it.
It does not.
ERISA tells you how a plan can be correct ab initio, but there's nothing that you cited from ERISA that says if a plan is not correct, this is how you fix it.
ERISA also provides plans can be amended. This plan provides plans.
And we've had amendment cases before, right. But we never had one where somebody ran in and tried to amend the plan to deprive a court of jurisdiction.
And the amendments can be, there's no limitation on the amendments either in ERISA, or in the plan itself that says you can't change the method of benefit accrual. The Lonergy case I mentioned earlier is really on point. There wasn't a lawsuit yet, but there was a realization that there might be a problem with the 133 and a 3% rule, and they amended it to say, if that's a problem, we're going to now switch to this other rule. It clearly, ERISA permits plans, not just in the beginning, but in the amendment process as well, to utilize all of the tools, all of the benefit accrual tools here.
It does permit amendment. That's clearly true. But I thought you started out by saying, agreeing with Judge Sintel, that the plan before this 1999 amendment violated the anti-backloading provision.
It did violate. In other words, it did not, Your Honor, pass any of the three tests prior to the 1999 amendment.
So if that were the case, then wasn't there an effect of that violation?
Yes, there was an effect of that violation, and the effect was cured by the amendment, which was done retroactive to 1976 to comply with the fractional rule, so that people got this, the cost of this to the client was something like $30 million of doing this. It wasn't a costless amendment to them. The people's benefits were increased. People who were suffered, you know, injury were increased by the, you know, by the amendment.
Can I make sure I understand that? So there was a true up, or whatever the proper term is, a true up, so that you, all the workers would get to where they would have been had one of the three legal options been complied with?
Specifically the fractional rule.
But there wasn't a true up to get you to the 133 and a third.
There was not. The judge ordered that, and obviously, you know, under
right,
remedy.
That's the issue.
Right, exactly. I see I have very little time left. I mean, I wanted to leave a little time for rebuttal.
You're actually over your time. We'll give you back some time for rebuttal. And, of course, this has a cross appeal in it, so you would be entitled to respond to that. So we'll give you some time when they get through arguing. We'll figure out how much at that point.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the... Go ahead, counsel.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Bruce, and I represent Jamal Kafafi in a class of over 23,000 current and former employees. At this stage, they're almost all former employees. I would like to, if it's permissible, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal or whatever the lesser time is that the court allots to Mr. Rice.
We'll give you a couple of minutes if you need it. Now, that's only going to be for rebuttal. If he doesn't say anything to be rebutted, you don't get it.
Okay.
Your
Honor, the heart of this appeal is appropriate equitable relief for violations of ERISA's backloading, and our cross appeal also includes ERISA's vesting rules.
Now, you understand the rebuttal is limited to that cross appeal?
Yes.
Okay.
It's undisputed now that those violations covered a period of over two decades and that they affected over 23,000 people. Hilton doesn't dispute the number of people who were affected. They're trying to reduce the number of people who will get any relief for those violations. The district court engaged in a very careful analysis and thoughtful analysis, and with which we disagreed in parts. But there's no question that the district court did yeoman's work in understanding all these issues and in explaining the basis for her decision. The review of the exercise of her equitable discretion is for abuse of discretion. Your Honor, we didn't cite the case in the papers, but Your Honor wrote the opinion in Peyton versus DiMario in 2002, establishing even that there's a wide berth given for the court's exercise of discretion in formulating make-whole relief.
Can I ask a question that
yes.
I think gets to the heart of this? Suppose the plan the whole time had complied with the fractional rule, but there was a statement of intent, the same 1994 statement of intent.
Well, that was
about the 133 and a third. Would you be entitled, even though it was entirely lawful because it complied with the fractional rule, to relief?
Well, that was one of the points that the district court addressed.
Right.
That she said this was not a case where the plan stated one benefit accrual rule but complied with another. So she didn't have to reach that case.
On the hypothetical, what's your answer? If it complied the whole time with one of the three lawful options but had the same statement of intent in 1994, what result?
Well, to some extent, it would depend on what do you mean by compliance. Do you mean that they're...
I mean IRS certified compliance with the fractional rule the whole time.
Well, if
the same statement of intent.
If compliance with the 133 and a third.
No. Compliance with the fractional rule.
I know what I'm saying. If compliance with the 133 and a third percent rule, which was stated in the plan document, would provide more benefits.
Right.
Then I don't think that's satisfactory because they have to comply.
So the statement of intent, I said, that that's consistent with your theory, I think. The statement of intent essentially binds the plan to one of the three, even if it had been perfectly lawful in terms of how all the calculations were done.
Right, Your Honor. But I think in terms of the district court, I don't think the district court looked at Section 5.4 and said this is the end of the inquiry. The district court, first of all, looked at the possibility, was this plan complying with some other rule? No, they were not. She looked then at what was the fractional rule being offered to satisfy this violation, and she found that that fractional rule was changing the plan's benefit formula, that the plan was offering 2% of pay for the first 25 years, but by application of a fractional rule, you would change that benefit so that for some people, they would receive 1.33% for the first 25 years. And so if there was a fractional rule had been formulated that left all the features of the plan intact, but only attacked the part that violated the backloading rules, then that would have been a different case. So the court didn't address that case of you know, is there and one point, you know, that maybe isn't obvious is that the 2% of pay formula for the first 25 years complies with the fractional rule. The fractional rule says that the benefit has to be at least the fraction. And if you provide 2% of pay for the first 25 years, that complies with the fractional rule. And so if that was what the plan had been doing.
So if it had done, sorry to interrupt, but if the plan had been doing all along what happened after 1999, and there were no statement of intent in the 1994 about the 1.33 and a third, that would have all been lawful, correct?
No, the fractional rule was not evident in any of the plan provisions that the...
No, I'm saying if it had been, if you take what was done in 1999, and if that had been all the years, if that had been in the plan all the years, and there were no statement of intent, there would be no legal violation, correct?
If the plan amendment, yes, our actuarial expert and the IRS agreed that going forward, this is a plan that was frozen in 1996, but if it was ongoing, that going forward, they could use this fractional rule. They could disclose it to their employees with, you know, effectively with reduced benefits.
Right.
This is what we're doing going forward. But
sorry to interrupt again, but if that had been in place the whole time, I'm just trying to isolate what the issue is. So if that had been in place the whole time,
it would have been a different formula.
But it would have been okay.
It wouldn't have been the same.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
So if that had been in place all along, what you would have been telling younger employees is your rate of accrual is 1.33% for 45 years, rather than telling them that your rate of accrual is 2% of pay for the first 25 years and then it drops off after that. It would have been a different formula. They also changed, there was a way that was defined in the plan of calculating the Social Security benefit based only on Hilton earnings. When they adopted the amendment in 1999, they changed that to include earnings after Hilton employment ended. And so that would also have been a different provision than was in there all along. So what we're saying is that would have been a different formula. We're not disputing that Hilton, you know, that assuming that people want to continue working under those terms, that they don't get a reaction, that they have that power going forward. But going backward, what we're looking at is make-whole relief. And that's what the Supreme Court has affirmed in the Amara case, that ERISA, you know, that equity in ERISA is directed towards make-whole relief. And this court, the district court, then has the discretion under ERISA Section 502A3 to formulate make-whole relief. She's exercising that discretion, and she's saying this amendment is not doing that. This amendment is retroactively changing the benefit formula. It's saying, in effect, we'll comply with the fractional rule, but in exchange for that compliance, you get a different benefit formula. So that going forward, they can do that. And, you know, in the same way, you know, we use the analogy of overtime pay. In the same way that if an employer doesn't pay overtime pay, you know, based on a $10 per hour rate, and they're charged with that going backwards, they have to use that $10 rate. But going forward, they could decide, well, you know, since we've been socked with that, we're going to try and see whether we can lower $10 to $7.50.
On the 1994 statement, the argument from Hilton is that that's not a selection for purposes of ERISA. That's merely a statement of intent with respect to the IRS to show how they're intending to comply. Can you respond to?
Well, it's a plan provision, and the IRS, it's in the application for determination to the IRS. It says, it asks Hilton, which benefit accrual rule are you complying with? And they say the 133 1/3% rule. Mm-hmm. Then they said when we filed a claim, they wrote us back a detailed letter saying we're complying with the 133 1/3% rule. After we filed the lawsuit, there was an initial scheduling conference with Judge Catelli. They submitted a written document saying that they are complying with the 133 1/3% rule. As late as October of 2001, there was a letter to the IRS from Hilton's outside counsel saying we're complying with the 133 1/3% rule. Even in 2005, when they moved for summary judgment and opposed our motion for summary judgment, the statement of undisputed facts says that until 1999, the intent was to comply with the 133 1/3% rule. This wasn't something that only appeared one place. This was their position. They had a very strange view of what compliance with the 133 1/3% rule entailed.
I guess there's
entailed.
Nothing that in the plan, though, that says you, worker, are entitled to benefits as calculated by the 133 1/3% rule. There's nothing quite that stark in the plan.
It says that the intent of Section 4.1 is to satisfy the 133 1/3% rule, and the representation to the IRS, to us, to the court, was that not only was that our intent, we are complying with the 130. That was the statement. They had a strange view that they could ignore the Social Security offset, and because the plan was providing 2% of pay with less a Social Security offset, their theory was that they could just ignore the Social Security offset and say that the plan is providing 2% of pay, and that complied with the 133 1/3% rule. Mm-hmm. So, Your Honor, as early as 1977, the summary plan description actually says that in some cases, the Social Security offset is causing people to receive no benefits. So the idea that the consequence of the Social Security offset was unknown to Hilton is totally wrong. And they knew that from 1977, that this was causing the benefits that people earned in the early years of participation to be very low, and they didn't do anything about it. We found documents from consultants in the early 1990s saying, we're 50% offset. It's a consulting opportunity. They did analyses after we started raising questions. They did analyses showing that the plan did not comply with the 133 1/3% rule or any of the other rules, and yet they still denied Mr. Kafafi's claim on the basis that they were complying with the 133 1/3% rule. The plan's enrolled actuary testified in a deposition that he always knew the plan was backloaded. They didn't do anything about it. The vesting rules were the same thing. The people, when we started raising these issues, there was an email that we presented to the court that said, you know, when did these changes start? When did they say that you had to count all of an employee's years of service for vesting purposes? We haven't been doing that for the last 20 years. They didn't comply with these rules, and it didn't set off any red flags. And the only action was after we filed the lawsuit, you know, after, you know, when the court is in the process of certifying the class, they adopt an amendment which is not providing make-whole relief. And we
think. What was the section you cited at the early part of your address about the court's remedial discretion under ERISA?
Section 502A3 provides that if there's a violation of ERISA or the terms of the plan, that the court can provide appropriate.
What's the code citation to that?
1132A3, 29 U.S.C. 1132A3.
Which?
It should be in our red.
It certainly should.
Our red brief.
I don't think it is, but I don't think the language of that section is in. It's not in your FA, I don't think. And I'm not sure that's
okay.
The right.
I'm sorry. You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm not sure that's the right. I agree with it. It should be in there.
Okay.
But you're the one who made it, so I'm not sure that's the language. I'm looking at 29 U.S.C. 1132A3.
Three.
And that says that describes the action that can be brought. One of us has the citation wrong here or something.
Well, it refers to appropriate equitable relief, right, Your Honor?
It says an action may be brought, I'm summarizing, by a participant, beneficiary, or fiduciary to enjoin any act or practice which violates any provision of this subchapter. It doesn't refer.
Or B, to obtain other appropriate equitable relief to redress such mm-hmm. violations.
So it actually refers to what action can be brought. It doesn't refer to how the court can accomplish that.
Well, if there's any uncertainty about that, the Cigna versus Amara case resolves it. The court
case is then
Cigna Corporation versus Amara, which so the court clearly has the authority to provide appropriate equitable relief, and the district court exercised that authority in a very careful way. They didn't adopt everything that we urged. The judge didn't adopt everything that we urged at all. And we're bringing a cross appeal about one aspect of that in terms of the backloading, that to provide the relief for the 133 1/3% violation, the district judge, to provide relief for the 133 1/3% violation, the district judge adopted a theory espoused by Hilton that people could outgrow the backloading violation. And as a result, she allowed the relief to be based on the average offset over all years of participation rather than based on the unduly low offsets in the early years of participation.
Now, is it your position that she was incorrect in her conclusion that they could outgrow or that she was not empowered to employ that in an averaging formula in relieving?
That adopting the outgrow theory was something that was purely espoused by Hilton. It was not something in the
statute. I don't care who it was espoused by. Is it your position that the court can't do it because she's wrong in the assumptions of the outgrow or that she cannot apply an averaging based on the outgrow?
That the outgrowing theory is inconsistent with the statutory policies as shown by the Treasury Department's 1977 regulations, which go on a year-by-year basis and contain an example that explicitly says that even though the average rate of accrual is satisfactory, this scenario where people have certain years with unduly low rates of accrual continues to violate the backloading rules. So you can't say, well, this person continued on, therefore I'm going to shift benefits back and analyze this thing based on an average. That the people that what Hilton's proposal is doing is providing a remedy for the people who worked for a while and left. The people who continued longer, they move out of the early years with low rates. They continue to have their benefits calculated on that basis, but they move into higher rates. And Hilton is seeking to average those rates and say that no backloading violation occurred. And what we're saying is that the backloading violation occurred and it needs to be remedied, and that the Treasury Department's regulations and the statutory language, which are based on accrual rates in each plan year, are inconsistent with the relief that the judge provided. If I could just briefly, since I'm getting close to my time.
We're over time, actually. We're letting you do that. No, I guess you're not yet. You're right. You're getting close.
Just briefly on the vesting, that the court wound up ordering that Hilton should have to count union service for vesting. And our point there is that there is no limitation of the vesting rules to union service.
You're not objecting to her including union time being counted.
We're objecting that limiting the relief to union service.
What is the relief you want that you say she didn't grant?
The relief should be for Hilton to count all years of service that were not participating in the plan.
Now, what does that mean on the ground? What time is it that you would ask her to order included in the plan? Describe that time.
Well, that Hilton has records of service dates when people started work for Hilton, and then they only later got into the pension plan. Sometimes that was because they were working in a union job, which was covered by a different pension plan, and sometimes it was because they were working for an employer that was part of the Hilton family but was not contributing to the plan. They have records of that. They do not have records of which was union service or other service. And so
I'm still trying to figure out what the order would say. Now, maybe you can't give me a simple statement, but if you can, tell me simply what you would say the order should say that she erroneously didn't enter.
That the order should say that Hilton is required to count all years of non-participating service, including but not limited to union service. So that is what conforms with the statutory requirement. It conforms with the plan document. It conforms with this court's case law in Holt versus Wimpasinger.
Can I ask one more question? Just going back to the two other changes in 1999, mm-hmm. Why, I believe the response is that's resolved by giving the option of the greater of the benefits under the prior approach or under the post-1999 approach. Can you respond to that?
Well, they're saying they're leaving the greater of the benefits under the 2% formula without compliance with any accrual rule. Mm-hmm. So that is, and that benefit may, and that was the district court's point, is that benefit is often, in about half the cases, that benefit continues to be higher than their fractional rule benefit.
So your theory is the greater of doesn't really help you when the greater of from the prior was itself an unlawful accrual rule.
Right. There's a fiduciary duty to comply with the law, and that fiduciary duty, it's in the plan document, and there's a fiduciary duty to comply with this intent to conform with the 133 1/3% rule.
That's a different issue, isn't it?
No,
and
I think
the two changes you're talking about. I was talking about the two changes: the 2% and the Social Security offset.
Right. That participants are entitled to the 2% and the Social Security offset delivered to them in a form that's compliant with one of the accrual rules.
And one of the three. Yeah.
Yeah. And the only way, even absent that language, that they're entitled to use the formula and comply with the rules, not to change the formula and then comply with the rules.
I want to back you up again a moment. Mm-hmm. The Cigna case that you cited as setting forth the court's equitable relief powers in the 1132A3 action. What is that in your brief?
Yes.
It is?
Yes. I think we alphabetically put in the table of authorities, we put it, the Cigna above Calderon.
I don't know what you just meant by what you just said.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
CI is alphabetized above CA. That's what I meant. You can understand why that was making it difficult for me to find it, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If appropriate, we'll give you back a couple of minutes if necessary to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But it would only be if counsel addresses your issues so that you would have time to group.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to just very quickly
deal
with first on this question of Cigna, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm glad Your Honor is going to read Cigna.
Let's give him about 5 minutes since he does have a cross appeal to address.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
I'm glad you're going to read the Cigna case, because the Cigna case, which counsel admits is the basis for his claim for appropriate equitable relief, says this kind of relief that they're asking for here is in the nature of an estoppel, and reliance is required. Here, there's no proof of reliance, and therefore, it was improper. No reliance can be inferred for some of the reasons that we talked about before.
You addressed the 2% and the Social Security offset. In other words, he's raised those issues as well as reasons why the 1999 amendment doesn't solve everything.
Well, but it does solve everything, and let me explain why again. To be sure, the new benefit formula is different than the old benefit formula. In some ways, it's more generous, and it increases benefits. In some ways, it's less generous. To some extent, that is a product of trying to make it fit into the fractional rule. But the reason it doesn't completely solve anything. But what it does, but when combined with the original formula, the aggregate formula is both not backloaded, complies with the fractional rule. And by the way, that's not just me saying it. The IRS, in this 2002 technical assistance memo, first says, well, let's first look at the new benefit. That standing alone meets the fractional test. Then it says, okay, now let's combine the whole thing. Well, since the benefit's always the same or greater, that also meets the fractional test. So it completely solves the backloading.
The amendment going forward meets the fractional test.
It also meets it going backwards, too,
right,
because it's applied retroactively.
That's what I was going to say. And it meets it, if it had been in place from 1976 on, it would have also been lawful, even with the change in the 2%.
That's absolutely right. And as a result of making it retroactive.
So it really does, as I thought, come down to the significance of that 1994 language, I believe.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And as I said, I don't think it's a matter of ERISA contract, or certainly as a matter of the Cigna versus Amara case, is any basis for finding as anything other than a statement of intent that certainly doesn't tie the plans hands going forward. What Mr.
I'm doing something very dangerous. I'm looking at the syllabus to the opinion, but I don't have time to read the opinion right now. So this syllabus to the opinion seems to list as a holding that the ERISA provision allowing participant or beneficiary to obtain other appropriate equitable relief authorized the district court to reform the terms of pension plan and enforce the terms of the reform plan as a remedy. If that's a correct statement of the holding of that case, then how does Cigna help you?
It's a partially correct holding, because Cigna also holds, Your Honor, and this is at the Supreme Court site, 131 Supreme Court at 1880. At 1880, it first describes, it says, what's happening here, where the district court's remedy essentially held Cigna to what it had promised, allegedly promised in that case, that's in the nature of equitable estoppel, and the court said that's appropriate equitable relief. Then it goes on at page 1881 to say, quote, when a court exercises its authority under section 502A3 to impose a remedy equivalent to estoppel, a showing of detrimental reliance must be made. And that's what I'm saying here as a matter of equity. They don't have that in this case. It's not here, and it can't be inferred.
Go back to the 2% and the Social Security offset. Isn't that a change in the terms from what was present before?
There's absolutely a change in the terms. It's an improvement in the terms. And there's nothing about ERISA and there's nothing about the plan that says you can't change it. You can change it. What you can't do is take away the accrued benefit that they already had. And the accrued benefit that they already had was what they're promised at age 65. And because under this greater of formula, you leave the old plan, the old formula in, they're always going to get at least that. They're going to get something more than that because at certain stages, the new formula is more beneficial and gives them better accrual.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but why aren't they entitled to the going backwards to the fractional rule plus the old social, and maybe this doesn't work, but you'll tell me if that's plus the Social Security offset and the 2% as it was before 1999?
First of all, they are getting that. They're getting the greater of the old rule, which is the 2% and the Social Security offset. Whatever that produced, if that's greater than the fractional rule, or they're getting a new benefit formula. Could it have been designed to give them even more? Sure, I guess you could have done something, but this isn't a plan. I mean, the plan and the fiduciaries for the plan, they have an obligation to protect the funds of the plan for the benefit of the beneficiaries, and it's fair and it's right, and the court found this in a remedies decision for them not to give the Cadillac, but to give something that complies with the law if it costs them less. I mean, that makes just sense from the perspective. In terms of the remedy given on the
130? I don't find any language that says they had to show reliance to get relief under Cigna.
Yeah, I don't have the actual decision, Your Honor, but I am reading a quote that I pulled out of a decision myself that says, when a court exercises its authority under Section 502A3 to impose a remedy equivalent to an estoppel, a showing of detrimental reliance must be made. We can try to find the decision, and if that's okay. I'm confident since
we've
got it here,
decision.
It says it.
We can find what's in there and figure it out.
The in terms of the 133% remedy, if we get there, if Your Honors get there, and I guess we certainly are there in terms of the argument, that what the court did there certainly was an exercise of her discretion, assuming that she's right that that's what we had to comply with. This idea of growing out, nobody's saying you grow out of a violation. What is, because of the nature of the way backloading
works. Growing
out
prevents the need for a remedy.
Exactly, and that's exactly what the court held. And we think it was, with one exception, we think, if her liability determination is affirmed, that's correct. The one exception is for people who left before 1994. We talk about the whole basis for this decision, and for her decision was this provision in Section 5.4, that wasn't there in 1994. People who left before couldn't possibly have relied on it. It's just not equitable.
Yeah, have gone beyond your time at this point. You did refer to the other side's appeal, and therefore they'll get a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try not to overdo it.
We won't let you. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
The growing out of that Mr. Rice is now saying that they're not arguing that people grew out of a violation, but they grew out of relief. And that is a concept that is not really based in equity. That equity is that we provide relief for the violations. We don't come up with something in between the violation and relief to remove people from relief for the violation. That the outgrowing theory has to be found in the liability portion, or it has to be some type of an equitable consideration where the court is in some way saying these people aren't deserving of a remedy. But that, that we don't go around and impose our policy preferences.
That's not quite the same, so they're not deserving of a remedy. It's to say that any harm suffered has been corrected, that there's nothing left to be remedied.
But the harm suffered has not been corrected, that in the model that we gave in the briefs, assuming that somebody had $5 per month per year of service for the first 10 years and $10 thereafter, that the $5 per month for the first 10 years does not go away because the person works 20 years as opposed to 11 years. That it's still there and it still needs to be remedied. And if the court could have come up with that theory, the IRS's analyses, including that regulatory example, shows that it's not an acceptable theory, that the statutory requirement is on a plan year by plan year basis. And so the people like our example of Mr. Williams should, who worked for 18 years with Hilton, that he should receive a remedy for the early years of participation in which he received an unlawfully low rate of accruals.
Okay, thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.